The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai. Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
But anyhow, let's get back to the soccer after that. Just to let you know that Minister Leo Varadkar has left us, having had Will Self's endorsement for a move to health. Will Self has also left us because he's got to go to that conversation with John Banville this afternoon. Stephen Donnelly has left us because he had to join his two sons for Father's Day, and they had gotten him his breakfast. So in fairness, it wasn't fair to keep them hanging around RTE reception for longer than an hour, because we don't like to do that to children on Father's Day. It's not very kind. So still with us, Gerry Howland, public affairs consultant, Stephen Kinsella, senior lecturer in economics and reader of Ulysses No Less, and also with us Owen Sweeney, who likes to go out in boats with me and who has been trawling through World Cup archive clips, and we'll be talking to George Hamilton presently. Owen, were you awake last night for England?
I was. Were they? That's the question.
Very too much space on the left. Was that the verdict?
I'd like that. That's a very succinct analysis. I feel like I should have a swinging chair.
I'm very proud of that. Now, you see, but I've been watching the commentary on the BBC because I know there was the handball, but Thierry Henry, honest to God, he'd some line
that's
the other night.
That's what guides your viewing habits.
Yeah, show me the grass, show me the goal, and he was just
a bit of va-va-voom and you're happy.
Gerry Howland is looking away in despair.
Is it compulsory to watch the World Cup? Are you going to be shaming?
Is it passing you all by?
Completely. I've been passing it by. No, I've no interest whatsoever.
It's only been 3 days. You've plenty of time to catch up.
Yeah. No, but there is a portion of the population who may be ashamed to admit it, they may be afraid to admit it, they may be intimidated by mass media into admitting it, but they have no interest whatsoever.
I'm one of these total fly-by-nights who only watches soccer when it's the World Cup, because there's like something like the Spain-Netherlands game, you can get into the drama of it. Stephen, are you watching it?
I'm trying my best, but I'm just basically work commitments mean I haven't been able to get into it as much as I wanted to, but I will probably for the last 2 weeks. I'll get stuck in when things get more exciting.
You haven't drawn any team in some economist lottery anywhere, no?
No, actually, I haven't. And this will be the first time it hasn't. I normally get, you know, Uruguay or somebody. Rubbish like that.
So. Okay, well, listen, before Owen has been trawling through the archives for us, before I go to that, just to let you know, by the way, the British Council, who brought Will Self over for the afternoon discussion on James Joyce with John Banville, they are actually recording that discussion, so it will be on jamesjoyce.ie in a couple of days' time. So anyone who is interested in that will be able to get it online. But Owen, take us back to 1966.
Indeed, I suppose, I kind of, as you say, trawling the archives there for something a bit left field, perhaps in terms of perspectives on the World Cup, nothing that hopefully be too familiar to people. Back in 1966, England hosted the World Cup, and obviously in the run-up to Brazil this year, they've been getting it in the neck from everywhere in terms of lack of preparation, in terms of stadiums and accommodation and facilities and transport and all that. But back in England in 1965, in fact, just before the World Cup came to town, there was a pronounced lack of suitable accommodation for fans, Anya, would you believe, and indeed facilities for their wives.
Businessmen coming, for example, from Brazil will bring their ladies with them and they'll expect decent amenities. One of the questions I did ask going round was what are the ladies' lavatories and powder rooms like, and I'm sorry to say they're almost non-existent on most of the grounds.
Birmingham, in common with many other big cities in this country, is not well off for hotels considering the size of the city. And the fact that the Queen's Hotel, a first-class establishment and one of the oldest, is to close in the end of this year won't help matters for next July.
Because of the hotel problem, football clubs have appealed to boarding housekeepers. This room in Sheffield will be offered to fans by Mr. Herbert Sykes.
I've seen Sheffield before when there's been a big match on. They're just walking about like spare parts. They don't know what to do with themselves.
In Middlesbrough, Mrs. Noreen Walters speculates on her guests.
Oh, they don't worry me one little bit. I'll only be having two or three, and it isn't as though I was going to marry them. I think as long as they don't start sleepwalking, we should all get on quite nicely.
Ladies and amenities, that's something else. Actually, speaking of amenities, let's hear what it's like actually over there in Brasilia. George Hamilton, good afternoon or good morning or good evening, or I don't know what time of the day it is with you there.
7:30 in the morning on you.
Oh, not too bad at all. So you've had a good night's sleep, I hope, after that England defeat last night.
I have not indeed, because we were working last night. Work every hour of the day that God sends, as it happens, because it's very easy to forget that there's a time difference involved and matches go on morning, noon and night. So we were live on the air at 2 in the morning or something And here we are again.
I know, I tried to stay awake, George. I'm sorry, but I'd fallen asleep. Because I had to be up early. But listen, your pink T-shirt would keep anybody awake, George.
Well, the pink T-shirt, I don't see what the problem is. The Giro d'Italia came to Ireland, didn't it? And everybody loved that. And all of a sudden, we're wearing pink and it's making the headlines. So why not?
It's probably the brightness of the shade, George. Pink covers a multitude.
Pink,
but it suits
the girls
you anyway.
Boys
yes,
wink, doesn't
exactly. It suits you. And you've had it. We all know that you're also, of course, not just the soccer presenter, but you're also the lyric presenter, and you've an big interest in opera. And is there an opera house there in Manaus?
It's an opera house in Manaus. There's a great story about that on you, actually, because Manaus is in the jungle. Now that sounds awful. But it's not as bad as it sounds, because basically the thing is the Amazon River, there are two rivers that come together where Manaus is, and then they become the Mayan, and they flow the 1,000 miles or whatever it is to the South Atlantic Ocean. And basically they discovered rubber in the late 19th century in Manaus, and they made a lot of money. And consequently, a lot of people came to Manaus, and they attracted immigrants from Europe principally, and they brought with them their culture, and they wanted something special in Manaus. And so they built this opera house.
Oh, George, do you know what? I don't know whether we can re-establish contact there. But that wasn't a particularly good line, so we'll leave that for the moment. Try and re-establish contact and see, is it any better? Actually, Owen, you have a George clip from the archives, from the many
bits of
culture and entertainment you've trawled out for us.
Yeah, no, that's the left field. This is just commentary, which I'm, you know, if you sit through a match, Owen, you're going to sit through several, I think, if Thierry Henry's doing punditry. But I like to kind of justify my time spent by kind of clipping sound bites, I suppose you'd call them, of what's said. And this is Inger from George there, who you were just speaking to in Brazil. This is from the last World Cup. This is a game where Italy had just managed an equaliser. They had gone behind, shock horror, to Paraguay. And the Paraguayan chap who scored and threatened to ruin things for the Italians was one Antonin Alcaraz.
And that is the escape from Alcaraz.
It writes itself. It writes itself. You know well when George Hamilton looked at the team sheet. Now, he plays for Everton now, so we're a little more familiar with him. But you know when he saw the name Alcaraz, he scribbled a little note to himself and thought, well, if he scores and then if Italy come back, I have a zinger to use. And he did.
That's what preparation absolutely does brilliant. You have another clip for us about pasta. This was when Ireland ended up at the World Cup, is
in
that
1990,
right?
Yeah, this is from...
How could we ever forget?
They're great colour pieces. They're great in an ironic sense that I suppose the BBC and ITV love to carry out. And when Ireland got to Italia 90, for our very first World Cup, footballers love all things pasta. They love the food and they love the sociability of it, and I suppose the romance of being away in Italy and sitting around in the big team dinners and stuff. So ITV went along to visit the Irish lads eating food, and it was the subject of this terribly scripted piece.
Marco Polo discovered it in China a few centuries ago, and we've been trying to unravel its secrets ever since. Pasta.
No. Tomato.
The Irish lads love a pasta. Cannelloni Cascarino, Tagliatelle Townsend and Macaroni McCarthy. But there's method in their madness. Its energy-giving qualities have long been valued by marathon runners and Tour de France cyclists. Rude Hullet even wears it on his head. Rasta pasta.
We have the lasagnas as well with the pasta, so it's not just spaghetti. And the ravioli we had, so it's...
It's come a long way, hasn't it, Jim, since we used to get it out of a tin and put it on a round of toast.
It's terrible, isn't it? That was on television in 1990, and it's quasi-racist as well,
and as,
I think
you know,
we can
as
agree.
We were saying, that's
yeah, you're not
that
supposed to
ago.
Take it out of tin and put it on a round of toast. Sorry, I'm learning something new all the time.
You're learning a lot here about soccer, Jerry. It's an important... Do you not remember Italia?
Was I do.
European... I remember. We had some big somewhat on here then, didn't we?
It was enormous, and they were all out shouting and screaming, and you kind of joined in, because if you didn't, you'd look odd.
And there's always this economic... There's something about soccer tournaments that they're supposed to be an economic feel-good factor, and we all feel so
yeah.
And spend money. Is that actually true,
really,
Stephen?
It's really, really strong. It's one of the few really statistically strong correlations we have, is that because people experience soccer socially, not just with their friends, but with essentially the entire society around them, especially around the World Cup. It really binds people together, and that's really good for the economy because you get a feel-good factor and everyone goes out spending. You can see, it's weird, you can actually see it in the advertisements, even though people aren't actually necessarily connected one-to-one with the World Cup. There's lots of other things like, hey, buy a big screen TV, that kind of stuff that's happening. And all of that is basically to spur consumption based on the feel-good factor that the World Cup causes. So it will result in an increase in domestic demand just because, and this is in Ireland, not in Brazil, okay, across the world. So it's a really good thing for the economy.
Okay, and do we have George Hamilton back or not? We don't. The line seems to have totally gone and he doesn't have his phone. But listen, the World Cup is back on RTE2 at 4:30 this afternoon, so you can follow everything that's happening there and George's gorgeous bright pink T-shirt. And hopefully we'll have a few more gems like the escape from Alcaraz. What other gems do you have for us, Owen?
Well, I have two quick ones. Have you time for two quick ones? Okay, let's go back to 1998. One of the great truisms of the World Cup is that England go out on penalties. They do almost with boring irregularity. However, the commentators are only trying to second guess whether one of the players will score or not. They won't. That never gets old, as Kevin Keegan proves here.
Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
See what I mean?
I remember that.
But
yes,
it's been unfair putting him on the spot like that, no pun intended. Anyway, and one quick one to finish up then, perhaps?
Yes, absolutely.
Who better to finish with, I suppose, than Big Jack, the man who brought us to our first World Cup. The very fella. This is him doing what he does best, which is speaking the truth.
There's only one team going to win the World Cup, and that team who win the World Cup are going to be pleased.
The profundity.
Oh, surely a politician couldn't have done any better,
The profundity was just gobsmacking.
It was a great moment. His brain.
But I remember the open top bus in the middle of Dublin and Jack, and yeah, it was amazing. But it was a swing moment in the national mood back then, and you know, it's the same thing with Carnival, the Colosseum. It's all serve the same function. These are necessary explosions of enthusiasm, periodically, lest our enthusiasm becomes deflated.
Of course, there have been the whole issue of the protests over there, and I mean, Brazil, I think, is the most unequal society the World Cup has ever been played in, even more unequal than apartheid South Africa.
Mm, that's
so
right.
I mean, that's still very, very contentious, isn't it, Stephen?
Absolutely. And actually, one of the subtexts to the entire Brazilian World Cup will be not only the striking level of income inequality, but the mass protests that have been mobilized by the middle class there. It's really striking to see a country spending billions on infrastructure projects.
Football stadiums in the middle of the jungle.
Which don't, at the end of the day, that's not going to help your average Brazilian who feels the level of inequality, particularly in income, but also in wealth, really keenly. And I, when the history of this World Cup is written, I'm sure it's going to be written in the context of taking place against the background of this vast income inequality that they see.
And actually, as you mentioned, income inequality, she's going to segue very well from football into economics, because that is one of the big themes in economics at the moment. We even have Bill Clinton and Christine Lagarde, didn't they, talking about you could fit the 85 richest people in the world into a double-decker bus, whereas, was it a quarter of the world's population couldn't match their same income, and so on and so forth. And we have the very famous economist, well, he's kind of the fave rave in economics at the moment, isn't he? Thomas Piketty, he's a French politician, a French economist, coming here on Friday, I think, to talk to TASC. And he's already been in the newspapers here for saying that we need to take action on property taxes. And he, of course, is very much in favour of wealth taxes to tackle income inequality, which he says is increasing. It's kind of the big topic in economics at the moment. Where do you stand on it?
Well, it's the topic in economics at the moment. It really starts in 2008 with a book by Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winner in economics, who really showed that inequality really harms growth, and reducing inequality doesn't hurt growth, which is one of the important arguments that's been made against it. Piketty and his co-authors have been writing for 15 years on documenting what happens to income inequality, but also to wealth inequality. And effectively, he looks at income tax receipts. So instead of saying, you know, how much did you pay, how much did you earn, he actually looks at the income tax receipts from the government. So there's a lot of, he removes a lot of the reporting bias. So he's assembled a database of the top 15 countries in the world. And he shows in his book Which is a slog, folks. You know, it's a slog.
Like Ulysses, is it?
Oh, I mean, yeah. The detail is amazing. It's beautifully presented. It's extremely well written. But, you know, there'll be cliff notes for everybody in a couple of years' time.
Just give us the end point being.
Okay, so the basic point is that the rate of return, so that's the growth rate on income that comes from capital. So, you know, when you've got an investment or an asset or something like that, is going to be greater than the rate of return that you're going to earn on wages. So effectively, income inequality will always continue to grow and wealth inequality will always continue to grow. The only solution to this is a comprehensive global wealth tax. The reason that you can't have a local wealth tax is that the capitalists will simply shift their income elsewhere. That's a real problem because it means getting several hundred countries, all of whom are stuffed to the gills with rich people, to agree not to agree to be taxed in an equal way. So it's not that it's dismal or that his proposition is necessarily unwieldy. It's the only way he can see to do this. Piketty's book is a gigantic book. It's also an Amazon bestseller for a 680-page, you know, tome stuffed with economic data. What it does is it puts the nail in the coffin of the argument that income inequality is good or that it's rising. He shows conclusively that it's not, and he's sort of nailed on for the Nobel Prize as a result.
Oh, wow. Well, we'll probably be all talking about what he's been saying next weekend because he's due here on Friday and certainly causing a stir whenever mm-hmm. he goes. But we're coming back to the much simpler subject of dads and the way they're portrayed in the movies after this break.